underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Author Kirk Johnson's new book, The Feather Thief, is a true story which explores the 2009 theft of rare Victorian-era bird feathers from a British museum by American music student Edwin Rist, who was obsessed with using the feathers for exotic fishing lures. Johnson had his own obsession with Rist's story, which grew as Johnson tried to escape the pressures of his nonprofit, and that focus became his new book, The Feather Thief: Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. It's a great pleasure to welcome Kirk Wallace Johnson to this week's book show. Kirk, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I will tell you right off the bat that this is one of the most fun, most interesting, and best reads I've happened upon this year. It is an immense amount of fun and really interesting. At what point did you come across this story?
Oh, it's hard to believe it was nearly 7 years ago, but I was about waist high in a frigid river in the northern part of New Mexico in the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, and I was fly fishing. And my guide that I had hired that day to kind of teach me the particulars of that river, at one point he opened up his fly box to tie a new fly in the line, and I caught this flash of this brilliant looking thing. I didn't know what it was, but it was a salmon fly, and it had emerald and turquoise and crimson and canary yellow feathers tied in this really gorgeous pattern, and I'd never seen anything like it. And he started telling me about the history of it, but then at the end he said, you know, if you think this is crazy, you should hear about this kid, an American who just broke into the British Museum of Natural History and stole hundreds of bird skins that were collected over hundreds of years in order to sell to this community of guys who tie these flies. And he made hundreds of thousands of dollars. And as soon as he told this story to me, and he only had to say a few sentences, and I was just, I mean, I just wanted to like run out of the river that day and start learning more, because it just seemed so strange. As to be almost like unbelievable.
The second word in the subtitle is obsession, and that is the obsession of the person who broke into the museum, who we'll talk about in a moment. But you also became obsessed with the story.
Yes, I fully admit. I went pretty hard into this and had some soul-searching conversations with myself where I realized that if I didn't take pretty decisive measures, that this was never going to end, this investigation.
Do you know what the aspects were of the story that brought that out in you?
At first, all I knew was that there was an American flautist who stole these birds to pluck the feathers to sell to a kind of mysterious community in order to buy a new golden flute. And I thought, okay, this is kind of a funny, quirky story. I thought.
I mean, right, you know, there, you're at the races, right? I mean, that's great.
Exactly. And initially, I didn't, you know, I had never even written a book at that point in my life. I didn't really know what I was doing, but it just, there was something innocent and, you know, fun and, you know, humorous about it. But as soon as I started digging around, you know, I would start taking screenshots of illicit feather transactions on these, you know, secretive forums and private Facebook groups. And then the things would disappear. They'd be deleted from the web. And then I started doing interviews. And at one point, a fly tyer threatened me and told me I shouldn't be poking around in this story. And so it became a little more serious. But then where it really clicked and where I think it became you know, inevitable that it would become an obsession is when I realized that this wasn't just, you know, pretty birds and, you know, pretty dead birds. They were that there's a whole, you know, centuries long backstory to these specimens, and that humanity has a debt to these things, that they've unlocked all kinds of secrets about the natural world and the things that are not just arcane, but that affect our daily life. You know, beyond just understanding evolution through natural selection, that we know that mercury levels are rising in the ocean because we can study historical collections of these specimens. We know that DDT pesticides, we definitively can link them to their impact on the environment by studying the eggs in these collections. And so at that point, when I realized that these specimens almost have a kind of, I mean, to me, I use the word magical, but that's not the right word, but that they hold answers to questions that scientists haven't even thought of yet, and that who knows what technologies might exist in 100 years and what questions might be posed to these specimens. That's where it became a kind of almost like a moral quest to try to find them, because this huge hole had been blown open in the scientific record. And by the time I heard about this story, no one was even looking for these things. But what I was up against was a fiercely secretive community that didn't want anybody poking around in this. And it's fairly easy to hide, you know, a dead bird or a packet of feathers, you know? Right. And so I was up against a lot, but that's where it really became a years long, somewhat neurotic search where I was just vacuuming up every shred of information, talking to everybody I possibly could to try to figure out what happened to the missing skins.
So let's focus on the year 2009. 20-year-old man, as you mentioned, an American flautist and a world-class salmon fly tyer. His name is Edwin Rist, and he is a student at London's Royal Academy of Music. He goes into England's Natural History Museum at Tring, which is home of one of the largest collection of the world of these bird skins, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a heist. So, how did he do it? What ultimately did he do? And is it possible to put a dollar amount on what he stole?
When he found out that he had gotten into the Royal Academy of Music, one of his mentors, a mysterious French-Canadian who he referred to as the Michelangelo of fly tying, told him, there's this museum in Tring with the most unbelievable collection of these birds. You've got to get up there. The important thing to recognize is that as good as Edwin was at tying these things, he was always kind of limited by a lack of the raw materials. He couldn't afford these rare feathers when they periodically surfaced on eBay. And so there were all of these fly patterns and recipes that he dreamt of tying. He just could never actually get the feathers that were required. And so he was limited to using dyed turkey feathers and pheasant feathers, and it just wasn't the same thing. And so he writes to the museum, and he lies to them. He says, you know, I'm a student photographer, and I need to take pictures of the birds of paradise on behalf of a friend who's doing a dissertation on these species. And the museum believed him and gave him access to the collection. And while he was there, he took photos of the birds, but he also took photos of the hallways and of the windows and of the entry and exit points. And he was casing the place. And over the next 7 months or so, he worked on his plot. In between rehearsals and classes and concerts, he created a Word document on his computer called Plan for Museum Invasion.doc, where he had a kind of shopping list of the things that he would need to pull this off. He swiped a pair of latex gloves from his doctor's office during a routine checkup. He bought a diamond blade glass cutter, wire cutters, and he, the night of the heist, took the train up from London, wheeling a large, otherwise empty suitcase, And it's about I was just there last week. It's about an hour walk from the train station to the museum. And under the cover of darkness, he slipped up this narrow alleyway that runs behind the museum. He scaled a 6.5-foot wall, snipped the barbed wire away, and he tried to cut the window out, kind of Mission Impossible style, with the glass cutter, but it was a little harder than he had anticipated, and he dropped and lost the glass cutter in the middle of the operation. And so he ended up just bashing the window out with a rock, wedged his suitcase through, and then proceeded to walk through these long corridors of the museum, which, you know, just so people understand, these are not like birds with outstretched wings like you see in the display cases. Their wings are pulled tight against their body, and they're very compact because there are 750,000 birds held in 1,500 cabinets, each of which have something like 50 drawers. It's a just staggering and massive collection. But he had a very narrow shopping list of about 15 species of the birds of paradise of New Guinea, and then a lot of birds from South America and Central America. And over the course of the next few hours, he relieved the museum of 299 of these birds. And the dollar amount is very tricky to get at. But I mean, my estimate is, just from having studied the marketplace, is that we're looking at about $1 million worth of birds in this suitcase.
Kirk Wallace Johnson is our guest. The name of the new book is The Feather Thief: Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. Let me ask you a question about the timing here, because it is important. The crime happens in 2009. He steals these hundreds of bird skins, including the Birds of Paradise, which you mentioned. That was in June of 2009. The museum figures this out and the degree of the theft a month later. And then it's almost a year and a half later that Rist is arrested. What led to his arrest? How did they finally catch him?
Yeah, you know, what's amazing to me about this is Edwin signed his name into the visitor's logbook. He showed his own identification to the security guard when he first went there to case the place. They had the thief's signature in their own book. Had they looked at it and looked up his name, they would have found that on edwinrist.com he was selling all of these birds using the Latin names. He wasn't even using slang. But kind of astonishingly, the museum and the detective, although she had a very full plate, really did not crack this case. Where this all unraveled was at a fly tying festival in the small Dutch town of Zwolle. And to kind of paint the picture, this is on a riverbank. There are large white tents with Scandinavian and Dutch flags flapping overhead. They're roasting salmon on spits. There are a lot of guys dressed up as like medieval kings with fly rods in their hands. And among the visitors was a detective from the police service of Northern Ireland, who I call Irish in the book, who was a fly tyer. He took up fly tying as a way to keep sane during these 12 or 16 hour stakeouts during the Troubles. And he had gone not because he was assigned to the train heist. He had gone just because he enjoyed fly tying. And he came across a guy who was in possession of some really valuable bird skins, and the guy was showing them off, and he just was making small talk, and he said, "Hey, where'd you get these things?" And this guy in Holland said, "Oh, I bought them from an American in England, a student, and the guy's just got tons of these birds." And that's really what led all of this to come crashing down. The undercover detective had remembered the museum heist, started poking around, and he's the one that called in the tip that eventually led to his arrest several months later.
So a couple of just individual facts here that I'd like to throw out, which I think are really stunning to this story that make it so fascinating. Number one is that you tell us in the book that most of the people who tie these flies, they don't actually fish.
No. No, they most of them don't own a fly rod. most of them wouldn't know how to cast it if they did. There are so many layers of absurdity to this whole thing, but this is the most of the practitioners of this art form, and that's really what it is in the end. It's an aesthetic obsession. It's an art form. That they have no clue. There's no connection to reality, and so the salmon that ostensibly these things are being tied for, you know, if there's no earthly reason that a salmon in Scotland should care about a king bird of paradise feather from the highlands of New Guinea. They're never going to meet, and we also know enough about fish biology at this point to know that salmon's vision essentially switches to infrared when they're spawning. For the most part, they're not even feeding at this point. They've just laid their eggs and they're striking out of aggression at anything that might come near their red. It's called the REDD. And so you could really just as easily catch salmon if you just snipped a piece of dog fur and tied it to a hook. There's no biology to this. This is a man-made obsession that's kind of run amok here, but they follow it with almost a religious adherence to these 19th century texts that say you have to tie this fly called Exordium or Excelsior or the Green Highlander or the Jock Scott only using this rare exotic feather. Otherwise, it's not the real thing.
Given when you talk about these books that they're looking at, one being The Salmon Fly by George Kelson, published in 1895, would give you an indication that this could have happened or that the recipe was there for something like this to happen, given the rabidity of the people who are interested in it of, well, if the museums are the only people who have the feathers, then that would be where they would go get them.
Yes, yeah, because these birds are nearly impossible to get from the wild at this point. Not because they're all endangered, but because they've been protected by international treaties and by national level treaties. So really the largest repositories of these are the world's museums and university collections. And as I've found out towards the end of the book, and this is where my own obsession really kind of created problems, but by the end of my investigation, I uncovered several more museum heists that were done by fly tiers for the purposes of stealing these rare birds to feed their own marketplace. I'm at four different heists now in addition to the one that the book is about. I see no reason to think that that's all of them. I was just at an event at the Los Angeles Natural History Museum a few weeks ago, and the head ornithologist there motioned me over to this display and pointed to the crowbar marks where somebody had pried open the case in order to steal some of their exotic birds. And these are the same species that are used by fly tiers. The marketplace is as ravenous as ever. And sadly, I mean, I think the book has led a lot of museums now to take extra precautions. I was just at the Smithsonian and they've now they've put locks on all of the cabinets that hold the species that were involved in this heist. But it's a sad reflection.
Now we're rapidly running out of time, but I want to get to Edwin Rist. So he is, they get him, but he serves no jail time for this at all. So talk a little bit about that and talk a little bit about the interview that you have with him. You have a multi-hour interview with him and then otherwise he's pretty much off the radar, right?
Yeah, so he never spent a night behind bars. The reason for this is kind of astonishing to me still, but around the time of the arrest, there was a very high-profile case in the United Kingdom, an extradition case dealing with a Scottish hacker who hacked into the Pentagon and had been diagnosed with Asperger's. And because of that, the Brits declined to extradite him to the U.S. His attorneys looked at their fly-tying flautist client and thought, maybe there's something here to it. And I should just make clear, I don't have any, you know, axe to grind against Asperger's. I believe it exists. I believe that I have extended family members with it. So there's no part of me that is coming at this with any kind of hostility or skepticism towards that diagnosis as it pertains to people on the spectrum. But in this case, he sat for about an hour with a psychologist who was given a direct set of questions by the defense attorney saying, do you think he has Asperger's? The psychologist wrote a report, which was subsequently leaked to me and contained some basic factual errors about what Edwin's motives were. I mean, Edwin admitted in the interrogation that he did this for money. But because Edwin's attorneys secured this diagnosis, they were able to effectively bind the judge's hands. And so what he ended up receiving was a suspended sentence, meaning that so long as he didn't break into another museum, he'd be fine. There was a small Proceeds of Crime Act order placed against him to theoretically garnish some future earnings. But that was that. During an eight-hour interview with him, somewhere around the six-hour mark, and I'm paraphrasing, but you know, we started talking about the diagnosis, and I said, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but you don't seem like you have it to me. Like you're making eye contact, you're reading the subtext of and the intent of these questions very ably. And he smiled, and this is a paraphrase, but he essentially told me that he became what he needed to become. At that point in his life, and he started rocking back and forth and rubbing his hand on his leg. And he told me, he goes, I never had any problem with eye contact before. I don't have any problem with eye contact now. But all of a sudden back then it was like, oh, eyes, I can't look at eyes. Mm. And he kind of had this grin on his face as if to say, like, he knows he beat the system that way. And so, you know, it's frustrating to me because it's, that is the sole reason why justice wasn't delivered in this case. And to kind of add insult to injury, 6 months later, after the sentencing, another man broke into the same museum and hacksawed off a rhino horn from the public exhibit. The museum had anticipated that this might happen, though, and so they had replaced that rhino horn with several pounds of plaster. It was just a replica. And for stealing a few pounds of plaster, the faux rhino horn thief spent 2 years of his life behind bars. There's not likely to be any future incarceration. He got away with it. And sadly, around a third of the birds were never recovered, and they're worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're still floating around to this day.
Did you ever get the golden flute?
even in the Proceeds of Crime Act hearing, the prosecution said, well, we don't, you know, we know he has this expensive flute. We don't want to harm his ability to earn a living, though, so we don't want to take that from him. So at the end, the judge actually said, all we can do is just wish you luck. So he's performing now in throughout Europe. I've intentionally not revealed the new name that he's performing under because I just didn't see any real need to. But no, this is not a, as much as I wanted to burst into some, you know, dim lit room and find millions of dollars worth of stolen birds, I did find some in the book, but that's where the obsession thing comes in, is learning how to cut bait, so to speak.
The book is just so entertaining and is such a tale and unforgettable.
It is The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. Kirk, I thank you so much for sharing the story with us and for being on the show. Congratulations for just telling an amazing tale.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor to be able to talk with you.
Again, Kirk Wallace Johnson's new book is The Feather Thief, Beauty, Obsession, and the Natural History Heist of the Century. The book is published by Viking. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.